Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host, Wheel of the Lost Souls podcast, and joined tonight by Val Heffelfinger.
Best record on the podcast, Paul.
Yeah, you are, although I'm technically undefeated. Because I didn't play, and I feel no one is more disappointed in that than myself. I really had all these intentions of creating all this content and getting some videos up, and I found myself just pining away for rolling dice and competing.
I thought that might happen to you, so maybe this is just an important life lesson. Don't go to the biggest tournament in history and not play in it.
Yeah, but I was happy to see a lot of my friends do well. Happy to run into lots of people listening to the show. Thank y'all very much for coming up and saying hello and what's up. Yeah, it means a lot.
You can count me amongst them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hopefully you got some people saying what's up to you as well.
Well, you know, here and there. You know, the podcaster's life is a bit more anonymous, but I did have the great opportunity to hang out with some of the Tabletop Tactics crew, and it's actually hilarious and, a bit taking aback at how they're literally celebrities. At one of these events, those guys wouldn't. I was just their official photographer. You know, they go, 5-10 feet, and someone would pull them over for a selfie or a picture. It was wild. I couldn't believe it. I guess I'm appreciative of our medium.
Yeah, those guys are good guys for sure. In this episode, I have a vendor segment to insert from Jay at Discount Games. We talk a little bit about what's going on with his podcast and everything, and I think it's really cool to speak with the guys that we have as sponsors of the show. Because I wouldn't have them on if they weren't cool people. I wouldn't have them a part of the show or associated with us if they weren't cool people. And so I like to talk to them every now and then. So you guys can hear that.
Excellent.
We'll put that in the middle of the show.
Nice little palate cleanser.
Yeah, I've discovered something about myself in addition to saying I need to compete in some tournaments, especially the large ones. but I'm not good at painting scions.
Okay. How did you arrive at this shocking conclusion?
Getting about halfway through painting 5 scions and being incredibly unhappy with my progress.
Now, forgive me for asking, but isn't it just a lot of like black military garb on them? I've never actually looked at painting one.
To match the IG color scheme that I've been doing for getting ready for the Adepticon team tournament. And it's kind of weird that the scheme I actually envisioned originally on scions. I'm like, this color would look so good on scions. And it probably does. I just don't think I figured out a way to make it look good yet. But with any painting stuff, I find if you just kind of stick at it and continue to, if you're not happy with something, then change the color, add a color, add some detail, add a shade, add a highlight or whatever until you get it the way you want.
And everyone kind of knows that, it looks like the actual Big Mac and not the Big Mac in the photo until basically the last step. And then it all sort of comes together.
That's a good analogy.
Maybe you gotta just hang in there a bit more with them.
I'm gonna do my best. Last night I painted their face masks, not their eyes yet, but just the mask, and that helped the overall look of the model.
See, already making steps in the right direction.
Yeah, but it's been a long road.
Long road.
But I'm sticking at it.
Paul, we're rooting for you.
Thank you.
I did get those 70 orc boys to barely 3 colors and based, so.
Well, let's talk about how you did.
I thought you'd never ask. I know the internet was set ablaze by my day one record, a perfect 3-0. I don't know if you heard, Paul.
I had you in my draft. I was following your every move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a really great first day. Don't know how deep you want to get into the weeds on it.
Well, no, I definitely want to hear about it. Because, we made some predictions about what we thought would win. Yeah. I said orcs. We know that didn't happen. I believe you mentioned Drukhari or some Eldari part.
Yeah, I think I said it was Eldari's to lose. And then I said Coven's heavy Drukhari, which were very good against me in the fourth round. But, yeah, actually, that isn't what wound up being the power build. In fact, the only real Eldari representation, if memory serves, was Harrison's, flyer heavy version of Eldari.
Right. I want to talk about that a little bit but I want to hear about how you did first, but then we'll talk about some of the theory around the tournament.
Yeah,
but we were
sure.
Both wrong. That's the important part.
Yeah, importantly here. And everyone was wrong about orcs. That was fascinating. Although they definitely gave it a good run. And coincidentally, the two big front runners for orcs both went down to Harrison. I was unfortunately knocked out in the fourth round. My tournament was easily the most fun I've had at a tournament in, all my years playing, and I've had some good times and some miserable times. Let's not forget the misery as well. My tournament opened up against AdMech, actually piloted by a guy named the Stig. And Stig is a regular on the Tabletop Tactics that I mentioned before. Just a really sweet dude. He was running all these dragoons and the electro priests and stuff. And well, I was able to really just sit back and shoot him a lot with my Ludas. Ludas on day one, I was rolling threes and twos pretty regularly.
Oh, what a charm life.
It wasn't too bad at all. And then in my second round, actually, is when I ran into what I thought was pretty much an auto lose. It was a list that featured things such as two mana cores and a wyvern.
Probably using the Emperor's Wrath as well, is it?
Yeah, he was loaded up with the Emperor's Wrath. I did get a table that was fairly terrain heavy, but that's not going to help you with the indirect fire. And I'll tell you, what happened was I needed to go first. I lost my roll off. He actually had a bunch of chimeras and stuff to reduce his drops when he felt he needed to. And this is a guy named Alex Matheson. He's a really, really good guy. And also, before I get into this one, I just want to thank all of my opponents. Paul knows firsthand, I'm a scattered mess at the table. I require a lot of patience to work with. I put myself on the clock every time, but even still, it was a hustle to get through my games. I had 200-plus models, because that seems like a great idea for a scatterbrained person to do. But I was able to get through them all, pretty much to completion. I did clock out, certainly... In one game at least. But anyway, in this game, he had reduced his drops by deploying all of his infantry inside of some chimeras that he'd brought. And I rolled that seize. I rolled that seize on him hard. And from there on, just made all the plays I needed to in the first turn, which included just my shock attack gun going off. And along with Ludas, just nuking both mana cores that I could see. And then also being able to deep strike in. And because he had none of his infantry deployed, I was actually able to get a big unit of 30 boys to wrap one of the tanks and then proceed to, probably took, half of his, various mean Lehman Russes and things offline throughout the game. So that was a game that, I think both my opponents should be proud, because he played it very tight and well. It was right down to the wire. But, in a matchup that I really felt like I was up against it, I was able to make some plays, and I was really, really proud of that one. So that was cool. In my next round, I had Daniel Hack, and he was not a hack. He was playing he had Vect with some Ravagers and some Harlequins, and I believe some Ulthway Eldar. It was just a really cool army, and he was a really sweet dude. He was a nice guy. And we played a good one, but unfortunately, he deployed the Ravagers on the board. And what that meant was, I was.
Did he expect to go first? Did he have fewer drops?
I don't recall. I don't recall how that went down. I think, I must have gone first. I would assume he would have had less drops than me, because I, triple battalion, it's a lot of drops.
It's hard to bank on, though. I mean, when that's... That's something we talk about a lot is, unless it's a 100%, you should be a little...
Yeah. One of the things was, I think the issue is that he had limited CP in the list. I think he had about 9 CP.
Okay.
So I think he was trying to be miserly with it.
Sure.
Because, and that was the other thing. He didn't stop the double shoot. So that allowed me to wreck two of the Ravagers I could see and some other stuff too.
Did he attempt to?
No, he didn't. He didn't. Oh. He saved it, I think, to try and kill the Ludus. But the problem was, is most of the stuff was dead.
That could really threaten shields.
Yeah, exactly. If memory serves, that's how it went down. But that game went my way pretty easily, and there I was standing 3-0 at the LVO, and my goal was to win my first game. Like, I was tripled up on my goals. I'm walking on sunshine here, Paul. I was high-fiving everyone. Yeah. I mean, mugged Sean Naden. Told him I'd play him on Sunday.
You coming for him?
And I mean, I was mostly joking, but of course now the delusions of grandeur are starting in your head. You sit on 3-0 and
you smell the roses from the winner's circle.
You know what I'm saying? So, obviously I was not going to be anywhere near it, and that's not how it turned out. But however, I got to play a pal of yours in round four, Justin Pizzafrato.
Co-captain of the Wrong Way Kids.
Right?
Buddy of mine.
And I'll tell you, the chillinest dude I've played 40K with in a long time. He was a really nice guy. Real calm. Which is exactly what I need. Pretty, we were pretty easy with one another. His list was basically Harlequins and Drukhari with no Vect. And this was the thing that, because this is the cool match, right? This is the one where you get to really stew on it overnight.
Yeah, who you're playing the night before, and you get to go through all the theories and whatever for the next morning.
Yeah, so it's it was, and looking at it, I felt like I probably had the list edge, and I think he'd probably agree with that too. He was running like I want to say something like 15 Grotesques, a bunch of Skyweaver jet bikes. He had a Solitaire, which features heavily in What Goes Down. You know, he had the Vexator mask. So he had lots of good tools. But I felt like if I could get the jump on him, that you know, I'd be able to take care of a lot of the bikes. And because he couldn't vect me, I felt like, you know, well, I'm just gonna blow him off the table. I get two on my Ludas in the first turn. I actually took the first turn, even though before the game I had thought that maybe I would go second. So maybe, you know, I got a little ahead of myself there and maybe should have taken second just to give myself a better opportunity to, you know, go and take objectives and whatever. But I went for the jugular. And there was a moment where I could have jumped in the first turn my Ludas into a position because the board was playing with, there weren't any, you know, so-called magic boxes on the table. It was just a big center ruin and then some nice big line of sight blocking pieces. So there were these really long alleys of line of sight. It was actually kind of cool to play on, and I'm sure not a table that he was happy to be have anything to do with. It was all setting up well for me. We were lengthwise deployment too, which gave me great range on him. You know, everything he had needed to come to me. It was all, oh man, this is making me upset. Anyway. actually, it's not, because honestly, it was a fantastic game. So what went down was I got two shots on my Ludas and then lined up. I figured I'd take out the jet bikes because in the immediate turn, they would be the biggest threat to a lot of my infantry because they shoot, D6 shots each with a -1. And, you know, they're pretty mean even if you don't have vehicles. And he had two units that were within my line of sight. If I jumped to a conservative place, so I moved my Ludas sort of just so they're all in this very narrow alleyway. I got line of sight to two, and I shot the unit of six, and here's a really big lesson, guys. Shoot what you can kill and kill it till it's dead. With rolling the mighty two on these, you know, piddly little Eldar jet bikes, I figured I can split, you know, 10 shots to the rear unit and put the rest on the big unit, and that should take care of it. And, well, they have four up saves and four wounds each.
Yeah,
and
a bunch of wounds, I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah, it takes more to chug through them, and I really should have just dedicated all my fire into that main unit, because what happened was I killed four bikes out of the big unit of six. Two of them that were left over are now out of line of sight. And then when I shot the second time, I put it all into the unit in the back, which was unscathed at that point, still had three models. And with my 50 shots, failed to kill the unit. It was down to one jet bike. So, you know, between my rolling, and I honestly don't know if he rolled above average, if I rolled below average, but I failed to kill a unit in the first turn, which was a shocker for me. Big swing. I had old school, failing to kill a unit.
Oh, man. Killed more. Yeah, that's kill more.
So
first blood.
It was a massive swing, which honestly, I'm glad I didn't realize how bad it was, because I continued to play as if I had the advantage. And also in my what was actually, I think, a smart play in the way that I chose to move the Ludas, the not so smart play, this is on my Facebook page, which I would call hashtag pure Heffelfinger. I had made it so my Ludas were actually a little bit in front of my Grot screen. And he has a guy known as a Solitaire who can run all the distance and then beat the hell out of anything.
He can blitz if he needs to get even extra move and extra charge and stuff.
It's he's pretty impressive, and he swings 10 attacks and can do it twice. And so he got under the edge of my Ludas and he killed eight, and I thought they were all going to die, but because of the way I removed my casualties, he was only able to pile into Grots. So I kind of dodged that bullet, and I felt like I was still in it. But because of this big fluffer of a first turn, and also the time it took, I'm now racing to try and get all over the board, kill his racks and all that kind of stuff. And it came down to a pretty decisive play where, you know, it was somewhere around the fourth or fifth turn where I, you know, jumped to kill the Vexator mask and did these things. And it was this big, crazy move, but it really didn't get me anything. So unfortunately, in that moment where I had to make the play to make the game, I just didn't come up with anything that was, you know, really getting me there, and that ate up the rest of my time for the most part. But he was able to just keep grinding along with his Grotesques. I didn't really have an answer for them because they were either tied up in combat or just otherwise unshootable. At the end of the day, you know, I lose that one, 30-24, but it was a great game, and he actually went on to be undefeated. I think he just had a draw
in the rubber match. Yeah. I believe he finally was defeated, and he went on to be best Drukhari for the event.
Oh, well, hey, well, I'm glad to have been part of that best Drukhari title. Well-deserved, and honestly, just a pleasure to play against. My fifth game, I roll up to the table and, I see a gentleman named Cody Morris, who's a guy from out in BC, British Columbia, a good Canadian boy, I'm pretty sure. And it's fun because, you know, putting down the amount of models that I have, some people just don't even know what to do with themselves. And it, I mean, that's maybe going a bit far on Cody, but he said a number of times, like, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do.
Well, it's easy to make a mistake with target priority.
Sure.
When you have so many, when there's a lot of target saturation and a lot of, you know, a lot of tools that you have in your toolbox, it is somewhat easy to make a mistake with target priority.
Yeah. And, you know, he had four knights. I think it was 2 gallants, a crusader and a castellan. And then, you know, a limited amount of guard with some mortars hanging out in a ruin. And I was able to just roll them up. And that was largely on the back of a shock attack gun just going off, like with.
I want y'all to know out there, people listening, these guys gave me so much grief about the shock attack gun.
Now, I gave you grief about the regular old shock attack gun. Now, this what I'm using here is the relic shock attack gun, which is 2D2
super shocker,
which is the custom shock or whatever it's called. And it was just phenomenal performance, because one of the things a friend of mine put me onto was. Having him as death skulls and then actually using a warlord trait to give him +1 to wound. So +1 wound against vehicles. So he becomes just a stone cold night killer. Because with death skulls, I'm rerolling in each phase. I can reroll a hit, a wound, and a damage roll. On a D6 damage roll, that's awesome. And then on top of that, you know, I rolled snake eyes repeatedly for strength in this tournament. I want to say 4 or 5 times rolled snake eyes for strength. But because he had +1 to wound against vehicles, the worst I could do was a 5. So he was always, you know, so he was always putting in work. And in this game, he must have polished off at least 2 knights. It was just incredible. And, you know, I just put him on the tallest piece of terrain. That's a theme that's going to come back to haunt me in the next game. But put him on the tallest piece of terrain and just go to town. And he was just beating up knights all the way through. It was fantastic. And in that game, I guess the final score looking at it was 29-27. But I think it felt a little bit more lopsided.
It's a slugfest.
It was. And actually, I had basically at the end, there's a lot of weird boys and grots left. But also a shock attack gun just sitting on top of a tower, and it didn't feel that close. Maybe Cody would disagree with me, but it felt like pretty one sided for me. And then, so I'm rolling in 4-1. The dream is alive. Going 5-1 at the LVO would be pretty cool. It's also worth, like, so many ITC points. It's a hilarious amount to even be, you know, in that top, I don't know, 10% or whatever it would be. And I get another Knights player, 3 Knights. This time I think it's another guy local to you, Lee Harris.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Lee was rocking Death Watch and 3 Knights, Castellan. A Crusader and a Gallant, and also, an Admech. And that's important because with the Admech, he had some of those Arquebus dudes.
The sniper rifles. Yeah.
Coolest snipers in the game. And then, of course, with the Castellan, he had, you know, the Shieldbreaker missile or whatever it's called. And so I know for a fact that he can hurt my characters, at least in one turn, and then in subsequent turns if he decides to burn the CP.
Well, your weird boys don't have a ton of wounds, do they? I mean, they got 4 wounds?
Actually, none of them do. So the mech, you know, the Big Mac only has 4 wounds. Weird boys only have 4 wounds. You know, anything outside of a war boss, it's actually pretty easy to punk them. And so the moral
that missile is expensive to fire at characters, though. I mean, I know people take it and expect it to always do something, but there's a lot of randomness that goes in from that Shieldbreaker missile. You got to use the stratagem to fire at a character that isn't the closest target, and then you got to hope for the best with the damage of the wound roll.
Yeah, hoping for the best. Another theme in what goes down in my brain here. actually, another cool piece of tech, and this is something I picked up from an even different friend, is that with the Big Mac, he can bring a Grot Oiler with him, who becomes a separate model in his unit. So as long as if he's got that Grot Oiler and he gets hit by something like that Shieldbreaker missile, you can just that Grot can just get annihilated and he survives another turn. So that would maybe work if it was just a missile shooting at me. Essentially, we're in Pointy Hammer and Anvil, and I deploy my boys up front, and they're in sort of this ruined box thing. And I put my shock attack gun in the highest point, just like I had in every game, except this is the first game that I've faced snipers, and I knew there were snipers, and I put them on top, and I said to myself, it'll be fine. Truth is, it wasn't fine, Paul. Truth is, he went first, and clearly, actually, he didn't even really know, I think, that talking to him afterwards, he didn't really know the danger of the shock attack gun. It was just his only option for a kill a unit, and for his, I think he had old school. Or maybe not. I think definitely kill a unit. It was his only option to get something. So he shot it with the sniper rifles, and because I stupidly put him out there, of course he rolls big to hit and to wound, so he's very wounded and very hit. So I have to burn the grot on it, and then he pays the 3 CPs and nukes his brains out with a missile. So immediately, I don't know if he realizes how big that is, because that shock attack gun on his own is going to probably take out a knight for me. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Ludas are not very, they're good at chipping away at knights, they're not good at finishing knights. So I was not quite.
Yeah, I found even with 25 of them that you struggle to kill a knight in one turn with them.
Which is what I was rocking. But the thing is, the game wasn't by any means over there. The other thing to his credit that he did was he was very cagey. He didn't come right up and engage me. He hung back. He was very careful of, he seemed to know what a claw boss could do to him. So he was very careful not to let my Mega Armor War Boss get anywhere near his knights. And then he really closed it in the last couple turns. It was a great game. One thing I would note is he was doing it on his own clock, but he was asking me a ton of questions about orcs. And so I was getting a little salty because I was actually getting a lot salty because he was confirming, you know, what he already knew about orcs. Because a lot of the people out there, by the way, this is a general comment of the players I played. I feel like the standard of 40K players has gone way up since the first time I went to LVO. Like, everyone would get to the table, say, I've never played orcs before. And then I'd be like, okay, so I'll run you through what the army does. And they're like, no, I know what they do. You know, everyone knew exactly what to look out for. They knew what the tricks were. I guess it's probably because of podcasts like this and others. But, you know, he was sort of confirming a lot of his knowledge. And I have, you know, if I have a gigabyte of RAM, like I'm using 999 megabytes of it to run this army. So to have to stop and answer a bunch of questions, I was starting to feel a little frustrated. And that came out a bit. And so I angrily slap the clock over and be like, okay, let's talk about grouch heels. And after that, I tried to get a grip of myself. He came and apologized to him afterwards. I was getting a little testy, but you know, I don't know that he really even noticed, you know, because he was just sort of on his game and
he just felt it. So it's nice that you were aware of that at least.
Yeah, maybe not the nice, because I wasn't actually too worried about losing the game. I was more worried about running out of time, because it's with that army for me again. Like you know, watching the guys on stream, I really need to see the guys who have high model count how they do it, because they don't seem to be moving fast. I feel like I am sweating. When I'm trying to run,
it's when you do it. As someone who's played a lot of high model count armies, I always finish games. I mean, I don't mind saying that. And you got to stay nose down in certain times. You just got to get some of that stuff done and then save. You know, you can still be pleasant and still have that exchange of dialogue and interaction with your opponent, but it has to be not during the movement phase.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Lee actually took it to me pretty hard there. He wound up winning 25-18. And so he got his one loss LVO, and congrats to him. It really was a great game. And like I said, he was very careful about when he committed, and he made the right choices when he had to. He did a great job again. And he had the right tools. The ad mech evaporated, but you know, the death watch that he did have was tremendously tough and had a lot of DACA and could just sort of own the pieces of the board when he did bring them in. And he brought them in late when I had less things to deal with them. And then when it all ended, you know, his Gallant was, you know, still on its feet, you know, deep in my zone. He got his line breaker. So it was just he played a really, really great game, and I'm happy to report that I only, you know, really cost myself the game in the deployment phase in that one game, which was great, because you know, I'm more prone to that most of the time.
Like, the wheels just completely come off in that one.
Yeah, honestly, like
with the deployment, I'm just kidding. With the, you know, the solitaire getting in and the Ludas only going so far.
The solitaire getting in was quite survivable. I still had 17 Ludas, you know, so lots left after the solitaire get in. But that solitaire is also on a 3-up invuln. You know, anyway, that's a different game, but
it's a lot less fragile than it looks.
Oh yeah, he's a real mean mama jamma. Yeah. So it was you know, overall I'm ecstatic with, you know, I played about as well as I could. I played against people who were awesome to play with and against, you know, right up and down the line. Each game was a lot of fun. So you know, the LVO, and then on top of that is all the stuff that you were there for, which is hanging out, drinking, and seeing everyone. I'm starting to feel like, unlike some people, I really liked high school. And I think one of the things I liked about high school was just sort of a really big group of people that I could just wink and gun my way through. And that's kind of like what Warhammer tournaments have become for me. You know, like it's great to see all these people that I only get to see at these events that I interact with constantly on, you know, Facebook and social media, Book. You know, so being able to go there, have some drinks and you know, see the player stars and all the other YouTubers and podcasters. It's just like top to bottom, an outstanding time.
I found myself needing to live vicariously through my friends that were competing in the tournament, and real happy that most of them did well. And a lot of faction wins, a lot of high placement in the ITC for the club. Real proud of them, and was real fortunate to be able to share that time with them at the tournament.
Yeah, man, they were all, you know, everyone had their shirts on. They were doing well. Not as cool as the Cash Money Hammer basketball jerseys that we had created for the
event. I'll be rocking that, dude.
Oh, yeah, I gave you one.
Yep, I'll be rocking it. I'll be representing that at one of the next things I go to.
It gives me incentive to actually get into some form of shape so I can wear it without a t-shirt.
Buddy of mine, Damien, did really well with AdMech. Straight AdMech. Well, he had a knight in there, but I count that. That's close enough.
Yeah, that can definitely do. Was he the AdMech player?
Yeah, if you ask me, yeah. Well, he had, you know, a lot of Castellan robots, had a Castellan knight in there, had call, you know, so a lot of tools to be able to do things, and went really deep in the tournament, actually. Didn't take the first loss until the fifth round, and that was against Nanavati. So, and it was a close game. Could have gone the other way.
Hey, man.
And this is pure AdMech. This is, and the only reason, or one of the main reasons that I'm highlighting it is that I think that was an unconventional list choice that many people may not have expected, but you know the game, you play the missions, and you can do well. And in a field that's that large, you can kind of, you know, it's what we determine. It's almost kind of random still who you encounter in certain rounds or what you encounter in certain rounds.
But at the same time, you can run into, you know, Matt Root randomly, and Matt Root can run into you. He lost, I think, round 3 to pure Blood Angels, Paul.
Hey, that's, you know, look, it never put it out past a good player to do well. I mean, that's it. So, and we play a dice game. This is a mission-based game, mission-based format. Anything can happen. And it was really cool to see that play out at a tournament of this size. So even when you slide the scale up to as far as it can go, we're still playing Warhammer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's always a puncher's chance. If old Val Heffelfinger can teach you anything, there's always a puncher's chance.
I like it.
Unless maybe you're playing Brandon Grant, in which case you probably don't have a chance.
Then you're losing. That's what shows. Which I'm going to do a spot with him pretty soon. That'll probably be on the next episode.
I hope he's on every single podcast that exists. I can't get enough interviews with that guy. He's a really insightful, genuine person. Yeah, I really don't like it. He gets called a robot and stuff all the time, and he's far from it. I think if there was a way for me to describe his demeanor is stoic. He takes it one game at a time. He's careful not to think, you know, to get ahead of himself. He's kind of Bill Belichickian. I don't know if that's a slur or not on this podcast, but you know, he really does approach the game in a way that, you know, you can use and apply to life. So I do hope you get that interview, and I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a good time. You know, I want to talk to him about playing when your power pieces are gone. And I want to discuss a topic of, and this is something that I was talking with this with buddies, just, you know, waiting on our plane at the airport. Like, when do you make the decision to try to go for boots on the ground? Is it even possible? Is it a myth? Is it the, you know, are you chasing? Are you always going to be chasing? Is it even possible to do it, kind of thing? And when do you make that decision? I think that'd be a good person to speak about it with.
For sure. I mean, you know, I guess you're probably looking at, or hinting or alluding to Alex Harrison, who wound up at Top Tables versus Brandon Grant, who is running a 7 flyer list. Something close to your heart, isn't
it? Let's take a break. I'll come back with Jay from Discount Games, Inc., and then we'll come back and talk about that.
Hey, I'm into it.
See you in a minute.
We're sponsored by Firmaterra. With their study, lightweight and portable tables, you can make war anywhere. Please visit them at www.firmaterra.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to a vendor spotlight segment on Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined tonight by Jay Larson.
Hey Paul, it's nice to chat with you again.
Jay, thanks for coming on.
You betcha.
Now, you run Discount Games, Inc.
That's true, I do, yeah.
And some other things. We talk about it on the show, about how easy you are to work with, and I'm real happy to be able to bring you on every now and then and kind of show people that. I hope they contact you and end up purchasing something from your store. And you just mentioned to me that you're able to also get web-only stuff from Games Workshop.
Yeah, so the way it works, and what I've already been doing this with some people, but I wanted to try to get the word out to a wider audience. But the way it works is if you shoot me an email at jay@discountgamesinc.com, J-A-Y, you'll want to have done a little bit of homework before you contact me. So go to the Games Workshop website and look at their store. And there's, I can actually do this with any item, but in particular, I'm assuming your listeners will be most interested in the web-only items. And so if you search their store, when you do it, the web-only items will have like a little arrow on there. And if you put your cursor over it, it'll highlight and say web-only. And so those are items that retailers can't order from normal distribution things. But if you look through their website and compile a list of things that you are interested in purchasing, first step is that you want it to be $100 or more of merchandise, because that's the suggested retail price, because that's the point where it can hit free shipping. And so then at that point, shoot me an email and, you know, let me know what items you're interested in, and I'll create a PayPal invoice for them, and it'll be at a reduced price than what it shows on the website.
Oh, awesome.
On my website, I have things at 15% off, and you can contact me on ways that you can get rebates and stuff like that for a better price. And on the web-only stuff, it's also a little bit better than 15% off. So if you contact me, I can let you know what the pricing is and all those details.
Tournament season has kicked off, so there's some things that people are looking for to flesh out their list, make sure they hit you up. You'll be able to hopefully save them some money.
Yeah, I mean, it's this can be an expensive hobby, and there's no reason that, you know, that you guys can't save a little bit of money, and it'll also help Discount Games Inc. make a little bit of money as well. So
there you go.
It's a win-win.
But that's just one of the things you're involved in. You also run the Chain Attack podcast based around War Machine.
That's true. Yeah. I've been doing Chain Attack now for years, and I've been playing War Machine for years. And we also, it ended up being popular enough that we started a subscription podcast as well. So every week we have a free podcast that comes out that's around an hour, and then a subscription one that's around 30 minutes.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's been really cool. So one of the things that I try to do with, I have two co-hosts, but we try to with, one of the things we try to do with the money from the subscription podcast is try to travel to various cons and then talk about that on the podcasts. And being able to travel to some of the various cons, I think, is one of the things that's a lot of fun about playing these types of games. So you had mentioned that you were looking forward to going to Adepticon.
That's right. We were chatting in the pre-show about how I'm kind of a staple at Adepticon. It's on my list every single year, and you're going also.
Yeah, I do love going to Adepticon. It's a really fun show. I mean, I like going to Chicago. It would be nice if it was, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks a little bit later. So
it's still winter for them. That's for sure.
So it's a little bit warmer, but, you know, Adepticon just is a really well done show. So it's always fun to go to.
Yeah, well, I absolutely wouldn't miss it. But it's kind of funny that you've been going also. We've never run into each other. That's because there are 5,000 people there plus.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of people. And it's the thing that's frustrating with Adepticon is that, like, the last 2 years in the hotel block that the event is in, like, as soon as the hotel block is open, I'm like on the website trying to schedule my room, and I'm getting like errors.
You got to be quick.
I'm there as soon as it's open, and it's still not letting me log. So
it's a bit of a race, but yeah, it's worth it. It's worth trying to compete.
Yeah, it is. So I have had many times when I've stayed at the venue, and it's way better. But yeah.
Well, thankfully, there's some side hotels that run shuttles.
Yeah.
So it's not that bad if you can't make it in. So if people are still on the fence about Adepticon and we haven't beaten into them enough, it's worth coming to. It's a full-on, it's the closest thing that I've ever been to is on like a convention level. And I go to several actual conventions during the year to what our hobbies do. So it's really worth it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I love about Adepticon, and even more so Gen Con is just kind of the energy that you get when you're around that many people that are excited about their hobby. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely something that's very exciting.
Yeah.
The other thing I love about Adepticon is that I'm someone who loves to eat. And I love going to Chicago and, you know, once a year and getting to partake of the cuisine.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you ain't lying. You are not lying. If anyone is coming for their first time and would like some eating experiences, hit us up. I'll be happy to give some recommendations. And this is not my, for me anyway, it's not necessarily expensive stuff. It's the quality of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the two easy recommendations, you need to go to Portillo's and get a hot dog, a sausage, whatever, and you need to have a Chicago deep dish pizza.
Yeah, yeah. That's...
Lou Malnati's preferably.
But oh, wow, okay.
Wherever.
That's an interesting place. Well, and you're going to be doing there, I don't know, are you doing War Machine stuff at Adepticon this year, or are you doing some other things?
So one of the things that we're doing that's pretty exciting is, I'm not sure if you've, so one of the companies that I'm a part owner of is a company called Muzon Minis, and we make gaming accessories for a bunch of different games. War Machine, we don't do as much with Games Workshop stuff because it's a little bit harder to make some of the tokens for them, but like we have the license for Guild Ball, some stuff like that. But one of the things that's going to be exciting about Adepticon is that through our booth, we're going to be selling a miniatures game called Judgment. Judgment is a miniatures game. It's a 52mm models. It was made by some gentleman in Australia, and the designer is coming to Adepticon, and he's going to be doing, he was at the last Adepticon, and there was a lot of good response to that. And so he's doing that again this year. And the game Judgment is you play with either three or five models on your side. And it's kind of based on a MOBA, the computer mm-hmm. style of game. And the miniatures are really cool looking. They're very detailed. The painters love them. And so he's going to be doing demos of the game, and we're going to be selling that product through the Muzon Minis booth.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Where can people find info on the Muzon Minis?
If you go to MuzonMinis.com, then that's our website. It's the front page of the website is kind of a lot. There's a lot of people who post mostly at this point War Machine podcasts that are hosted through Muzon Minis. And then there's a link there to our store, but also the direct URL is musonstore.com. And yeah, that'll show you some of the stuff that we do.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And I was just checking out this Judgment game with the miniatures. They do look pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of the reasons I think of why it did pretty well at the last Adepticon is that all of the models that were released, I had painted up by someone who is a really high level. I'm sorry, crap painter. You know, I commissioned a friend to paint the models, and so the people who would walk by the booth would be like, "Wow, these models look amazing!" And so they're large models that just have really cool poses, really cool sculpts, etc. So
that's neat, and I like pushing sometimes. I mean, you know, I play largely the heroic 28mm, 32mm stuff
for right, yeah,
40K. But yeah, some of my favorite board games have like larger, you know, what appear to be like epic scale miniatures. You feel like you're doing something a little bit more special.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty neat. So you'll have a booth there from it's Muse, M-U-S-E on Minis.
Correct, yeah. Uh-huh.
You'll have a booth at Adepticon.
Yes.
We can find you there. Yep. Where you'll have your accessories in store and also this Judgment game. That's pretty cool.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Pretty neat. How often do you release your Chain Attack podcast?
We do, so once a week we do our free podcast that's an hour, and once a week we do our subscription podcast that's a half hour.
It's a nice schedule. And what are some of the things you cover? Because if people are maybe interested in getting into War Machine, if they haven't already, or looking for some more content to consume, what are some of the things that you cover on that show?
We initially started out as a podcast that did battle reports for War Machine, but then we got really busy with life, and it was just kind of difficult to do a battle report every week. But we'll talk about changes that are going on in the game. We'll talk about one of the things that we'll still do fairly often is talk about lists that are that you could consider. And then when we would do the battle reports in the past, we would play a game and then grade the caster and talk about their abilities, and we'll still sometimes talk about, like, we'll create a list or talk about a list and then create the caster after that. And so some stuff like that is
So breakdowns, competitive stuff, people wanting to improve and up their game.
Yeah. The main thing that we try to accomplish or sound like is it kind of feels like three friends that are talking about a game they love, and hopefully it feels kind of like a conversation that could be happening in any number of game stores among friends, you know, after a game night.
Well, Jay, man, thanks a lot for coming on and taking the time and telling us more than just the retail side of what you're into. It's pretty interesting to me.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, dude, I hopefully can check in with you later on, maybe even meet up at Adepticon, and again, maybe have a little on-site segment. We'll see what's going on then. It's not that far away. I got a lot of painting to do. It's giving me a little anxiety right now.
Yeah, it's not. I actually head to the Las Vegas Open next week, and so there's a lot of stuff.
Oh, well, heck yeah, I'll be there too.
Oh, well, there we go.
We'll make it happen, man. Well, Jay, have a great rest of your night, and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. I still got vowels.
Hey, Paul, still here.
Thanks for joining me. Okay, so I said that I thought Flyers weren't going to make it because they couldn't make it past the Orc threat.
Yeah.
And I still maybe stand to that in a three round. I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on...
You could just not play them.
Yeah, you could. You really could. But then here we go. More Flyers. Time and again, you know, I basically doubled the Flyers that I would take ended up in the top spot.
Yeah, it was...
the top table.
Yeah, we're talking about Alex Harrison, a pretty noteworthy player from the United Kingdom. He was running a lot of Flyers. He was running a Drukhari Razor Wings, basically three of them, in a Cabal of the Black Hearts. So that opened up his Vect opportunities. He also had an Azurani Air Wing, two Crimson Hunters. Wait a minute. Sorry, three Crimson Hunters in that one. And then in the Yanari detachment that he took, he had a, what's the psychic
Hemlock
one? He had a Hemlock, yeah. So, although I don't actually, that's what I remember his list being, but I don't see it on here. Maybe I'm crazy.
A lot of Flyers. Seven Flyers.
A lot of Flyers.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay, but not just Flyers, pal. He also had 18 Scat Bikes. Remember those?
Yeah, I do.
Remember those? And so he had those in the Yanari detachment, and, you know, that is a tremendous amount of anti-infantry DACA. Just able to, shoot twice at times.
From a long range, too. So that's...
From a long range. Also get some benefits from, I think he took it as the detachment from Vigilus. Let me just have a double check here. I don't actually see that. Never mind.
No, it's a lot of mobile firepower. I mean, the Scatterbike's putting out four shots apiece, you know, so that's an incredible amount of D6 rolling. And then the planes put out, well, the Drukhari planes put out a lot of volume of fire, and then the Eldari flyers put out tons of quality firepower. So how do you add a lot of high strength, good AP shots?
Correct. And I mean, the Eldari ones are also minus two to hit because they're LA talk. It's pretty ruthless. And because that thing that you were mentioning about boosting the ground with this list is very hard to get, because not only do you have to unlodge 18 jet bikes, which, you know, are T4, 3-up save, hard to touch because they can fire and fade, they can get behind ruins, do all kinds of fun shenanigans that way. But also, you know, outside of that, you got a bunch of characters that are, you know, screened by the best screening units in the game, ironically enough, Flyers. So you can't target them. And so it's actually, unless you have, you know, Gilliman and 40 scouts, you know, you don't have the means to actually take out the characters to boot them, because you can't drop in and get anywhere near them, can't target them with conventional
weaponry.
Yeah, that's
a good assessment, though. I think that when you see that many Flyers, it has to at least occur to you, do I do that? Do I try to go for that? Is it even possible? And I think that that's a topic. I don't personally know the answer. I mean, part of me wants to say, like, Maybe try to come up with a strategy for it round one and see how it works out. If you need to pursue it again in round two, but I don't even know, that could just be wasting your time.
Yeah, well, clearly a guy who's bringing seven flyers and went that kind of distance had a real good plan to prevent boots on the ground from happening to him. And
yeah, absolutely.
I'm certain that never occurred. One thing that does that, and certainly anecdotally, just talking to some of the people who played him, did come up was move blocking the flyers with hordes and causing them to auto crash.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that has a big footprint. It is possible to bring down flyers just by giving them no place to go.
It's real hard, though, with the Eldari flyers because of the ability to pivot twice.
Yeah, but it can be done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, these are all things you should be thinking about. And, you know, we'll save that conversation for a little bit another time. I'd love to hear people's thoughts on that may be listening and have encountered it and maybe do it on the regular. I know that in all my playing since that rule has come about, it has actually happened to me one time. So it's rare, but it seems like it's possible. And when do you make that part of your strategy?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the a good reason to consider a Warhammer TV sub is the fantastic coverage from Frankie and Jeff Robinson all throughout the weekend, including the top table game. I think you also get a chance to see Sean Naden on that in that stretch. You know, some really hot top flight players on there. And then if there's anything you watch, the game between Grant Harrison to clinch the thing, because I think on paper coming into it, Grant running sort of a traditional Castellan, not traditional, but you know, a Castellan plus 80 Catechin bodies, mm-hmm. Plus some tanks, that matchup just on the face of it looked to edge pretty heavily in Harrison's favor. And Harrison is not the ITC and LVO champion, so it's it's well worth the watch, because I think it is a clinic in target priority and thinking through what matters, what he needed to do to win. So well worth the watch, and also fun to see commentators trying to figure out what a top player is actually thinking.
more on that coming. We'll have some talking with the champion ourselves, and looking forward to doing that. Next big tournament coming up for me is going to be Adepticon.
Ooh, that's a big
planning,
one.
Planning for the team event and that. Going to be, I've been painting my behind off. Again, I talked a little bit about that at the front of the show, and you can see some of my work up online on my various streams and stuff. I'm going to keep that flowing. It's at the time we're recording is, it's 41 days to Adepticon.
That's it, eh? It's amazing how fast Adepticon comes on the heels of LVO.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then right after that, get the Barnyard Brawl in South Carolina. Going to be going to that.
A tantalizing event for me as well.
Going to be a ton of people there. It's going to be a good time.
They got a whole barn.
Yeah, well, it's going to be in a different venue than they've been running the event. So it's going to be larger and have a couple of in area bars. It's going to be a good time. That event routinely draws a bunch of people and a bunch of nice people from the area. And I think we're going to get a lot of out-of-towners. I'm also an out-of-towner from that area.
Well, it's nice to see the Southeast getting some variety to their large events, more GT options. I know for a while that was a sticking point, that it was hard for guys in the Southeast to actually get their majors in. So here we go. Here's one. And I know there's a bunch of others too, in Florida and Alabama.
We'll be talking about it as we get closer to them. I hope, anyway. I want to continue this enthusiasm for the tournaments, because there's never been a better time to be playing 40K in large groups.
100%.
Now, at the LVO, I got the opportunity to play Kill Team Arena a few times.
And how'd that go?
I enjoyed it. It's a little more board gamey, and that is a compliment. Mm-hmm. I like the aspect of Kill Team with the ruins and kind of 40K on a very small scale. This is similar, but there's not a lot of terrain that one might have to hassle with. It's more kind of close quarter, going around walls and line of sight and doors and things are part of the experience. But it was very extremely easy to manage.
Well, that's fantastic. I know I've really enjoyed the Rogue Trader board that it came with. I haven't actually played the Rogue Trader part. I've actually just bought that board, and I really enjoy the, I think you mentioned it pre-show. It's sort of like, what was the name of that close quarters 40K variant?
Zomortalis.
Yeah, has that feel to it. So it's super cool.
Well, line of sight going around corners. The fact that you're, like, see the IG orders or whatever, you actually, when you measure your distance for things, you measure them around corners and stuff too. So it's, you've got to really think about that and where you're positioning. So it, everything plays out. Your positioning matters. There's missions. The missions were done really well. I wish Brant was here to talk about it. We'll certainly be continue to explore that. But the missions were done well. The game played very smoothly. There's a little bit of element of kind of choose your poison. You get to pick your own mission elements before the game starts, and you reveal them when you start scoring them. So there's a little bit of subterfuge, and you could possibly feint. I'm not claiming I was good enough to conceal what my objectives were. You can actually see. You can see my first game playing out on YouTube right now.
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah, we recorded the whole thing and walk through it. That was my first game of Kill Team Arena.
Yeah, I'll definitely double back and take a look at that, because I have to stop donating $20 for Sunday events to FLG, because I, instead of playing in the Kill Team tournament, I decided to be hungover as heck and go to a buffet. So that's what I did.
Cool. That's cool.
You know what? It was the correct life choice. That was very good.
Yeah, but I mean, it was extremely fun. I liked how it had the aspect, because it's built, you know, for arena is for tournaments, and so you could conceivably run a full flight of these and not have to be worrying about painting ruins and stuff. I mean, it seemed a lot easier for an organizer to flesh out an event than it would be for the original release of Kill Team. Not that you shouldn't play that, because that's, I mean, I think that it has its own charm too, especially when you're playing and you already have that. But in a competitive sense, in a tournament sense, this seemed like it flowed pretty well.
Did you feel like it played faster, or was it about the same like the time as a regular?
It's about the same. Yeah, okay. I didn't feel any increase in speed. Now, we were actually going through it. It took us maybe about 50 minutes to run through. I think you could conceivably play in an hour per round, and everyone's going to have sufficient time, especially when they're not going through their first, run an arena.
Yeah. It's such a good time to be a GW fanboy. I mean, between Underworlds, Kill Team, 40K, Sigmar had a massive tournament.
Yeah.
It was just such a spectacle of all the different ways you can play.
With the arena stuff, the missions are, they're laid out on a card, and it tells you how to set the environment up. There's a way to score a bonus point, in there, and then there's ways you can score your own objectives, and then it is, you score a point for killing things. It's kind of like a blend of an ITC style format and a little bit of choose your own adventure format. I mean, it has some of the things. It's got some progressive objectives. It's got basically every tournament in innovation boiled down into clearly, easily defined and described missions.
Well, I think, I don't know if our listeners might remember, I was pretty excited for the Kill Team pack from Nova.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably if you go back and look at that, it's sort of a precursor or a hint at what came out with Arena. And I was really impressed with the tightness of that rule set. So if they formalized it and made it its own game, then I'm all for it. And still hoping to see it for 40K maybe sometime.
You build your roster exactly like you do for Kill Team. I mean, the only thing different is the board. I mean, I shouldn't say the only thing, but that's the only thing you're really going to notice differently is the board. So it was fun. I'll be playing more of it.
Heck yeah.
God, what else? I wandered around and got to talk with people. That bar there in Bally's is, you basically can't walk without going past it. So it's kind of like a magnet for folks.
It's a hub. I saw you holding court there one of the nights.
Well, it's fun because that's where everyone passes by. So it's like, oh, you see somebody you know, so you stop, and then somebody that knows you passes by and they stop. And then pretty soon you got, a whole crew of like-minded folks hanging out, having a good time.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah. Final stop on the pub crawl as well.
There's a place called Bluebird Chicken or something like that.
Bluebird Chicken.
Something. Serves fried chicken and beer.
I wish I had known of this place. I wound up at Ellis Island, which was a cool little casino and rib joint.
You can get a 32-ounce beer in a to-go cup for $10.
That ain't bad. Still not as good as the $3 King Can from like the random convenience store and the in between the casinos that I found.
But. No, that's strong. But that's the thing about Vegas is that proximity to where the place is everything. You know, if you go one level deeper, it's a little.
That's absolutely right.
But I ate some good food.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you get up? Did you get to a buffet?
I didn't. No, I didn't. And I think the time that everyone went, I just wasn't feeling up to getting out.
Wasn't up to eating solid food.
We played some other board games, some card games. Yeah, it's just, it's cool to get out to these things. I mean, I know that we are somewhat, you know, I guess real big proponents of this kind of stuff, but, this is one of the great ones and it's worth trying to get to, but also, you know, maybe that scale of it isn't your thing, but, you know, it's just where everybody's there. You can look around, you're always seeing somebody, you know.
There was a neat level of, like yourself, hangers on, like people, people who showed up just to hang out. They weren't playing in anything.
Railbirds is what they are in Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and notable ones too, who weren't participating in anything in particular, but they were there and having a great time. If it's something you can do, do it. It is a fantastic event. I would recommend it without any question. And the tournament itself for 40K singles got to 660 this year. Or thereabouts. And that's just a phenomenal achievement of just logistics. When you consider that's 330 tables, just for the main event.
I think they said this, you made a set of terrain per day for the last year.
Yeah.
For a 40K table. And they look good.
But I mean, this is not, Rome was not built in a day with these guys. You know, this has been a long-term plan, and I've been so fortunate to get to enjoy it over the last 3 years as it's continued to grow. And so who knows? I'd be real curious to know what their cap is at Bally's, how far they could even, you know, how much more they could grow the 40K tournament if they had the inclination. You know, can we see 1,000 people in there playing 40K in one tournament? I don't know. That'd be pretty cool.
Well, I can tell you that I will be playing in the next one.
You better be, Paul. I mean, maybe I didn't give you a hard enough time in lead up to it. I mean, I knew you were making a horrible mistake, but
it was tragic. I need to be real. I mean, I'm not claiming any win record or whatever, but I just know I needed to be rolling dice.
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
so speaking of the win records, our draft, we talked about this, you know, kind of casually. I don't know if we gave any information on what we actually did.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
We competed in a fantasy draft. A few guys and one of our brother clubs and the Wrong Way Kids, we got together and compiled everything into a list, put it into an online draft tool, you know, that people use for actual sports. A league draft of players for little leagues and that kind of stuff. I mean, it was this adaptable
table sports.
Tool.
Tabletop fantasy.
It's yeah, cool. And turn it into, you know, we essentially were drafting like we were doing NFL players,
yep.
Soccer players, whatever.
Yeah, it was a wild. This is stuff that came together in the week leading. This might be something that might get a little bigger next year because when we started doing it, then there were at least two copycat leagues that immediately sprung up, and these were in the like last days before the event. So I think that there was a lot of passion for it, but I just can't remember, Paul. How did you wind up in the final standings?
Oh, okay. I ended up like I end up in most drafts, third.
Third. Oh, that's too bad because I got a nice tidy $50 US for my second place finish.
Second place. Yep. God, but I was leading going into the fifth round.
I didn't look at the scoreboard. You know, I just kept my head down, kept working.
How it worked, we had it set up to where players got a certain amount of points for wins, certain amount of points for loss, and then a certain amount of points for the amount of battle points that they scored. And someone graciously did all this tabulation in between rounds. And I mean, they ran the draft like you would. And so it was neat competing against what we have 11 people.
I think it was 10 person league.
Yeah,
it was pretty phenomenal. I thought it was really, really cool. So maybe the guys who did it will trademark it and make it open to a wider audience next year.
Now, Val, you were on my draft list, so all this gloating about me coming in third was largely because of.
Largely, I'm just a small piece of the puzzle. Okay. And I got you some quality wins.
You did. You did. I was proud. I mean, I was proud of everybody I knew there. I mean, it was, apart from when we talk about everybody having a good time, but a lot of folks did really well.
Yeah. It was impressive. Like I said, I think just the quality of players in general, if you can just make a broad statement, is so much higher than it was, you know, two, three years ago when I started playing. And the respect for playing this as a game, and also, you know, the hobby was still there. You know, mm-hmm. there's still beautiful armies all over the place.
I'm glad you brought up the hobby stuff, because they actually gave awards out for the hobby track. And I know that we are partially responsible for that, people participating and be able to compete in a hobby track.
Yeah, that was super cool. And they got proper trophies too.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. Just the enthusiasm for all aspects of what we do is extremely high. And then what does that actually mean? That means when you're walking around the tables, you are constantly like, oh, let me check that figure out. Let me check out that paint job. Let me check out that conversion. I mean, it's a spectacle.
Like, there was not one army I played and like that was not very respectably put together and presented. They were all fantastically painted, and actually I probably had the worst looking of them for the bunch, because 70 of my boys were basically three colors and based. You know, like it was phenomenal. And, you know, you go back, you know, to my first LVO, there was gray plastic on the table. And, you know, I think that spoke to the fact that, you know, you had to keep the barrier of entry so low that you didn't turn away any potential players.
Mm-hmm.
But now that the enthusiasm is so high for the game that, you know, people will commission it, they will stay up until the last possible second painting to get ready. People are willing to commit and come at it from all angles. And so I was thoroughly impressed. You know, I think it's only a year ago that they actually started enforcing a painting minimum. I think last year was the first year that they did that at the LVO, you know, with the threat of pulling models and things. I didn't hear, and I guess maybe we'll hear it when we hear some recaps from some of the guys who are running it, I didn't hear of anyone getting a model pulled. It's just sort of a fact of life that you've got to have at least three colors in base to be able to play in these events now, and that's a wonderful thing.
The odds say it had to have happened.
They sure probably did, but I mean, you know, when the rule first came on, there were some notable times where models had been pulled, and you know, people unfortunately had to deal with that. Whereas maybe that's not as much the case. Well, I guess we'll find out as more stories come out, but it sure seems like people have embraced the fact that to play, you got to have it painted.
I believe it. And it's, again, great to see it. And it's just got me really excited about rolling dice. I cannot wait to get some games that I'm actually going to be playing very soon. I have a long weekend coming up.
Not too bad. Not too bad.
Looking forward to get some games in. I'd like to go ahead and jump into the finishing move segment.
Let's finish it up.
So finishing moves this week is about stripes. Told you about painting Scions, and you can actually see evidence of this in one of Duncan's videos. It's a two-parter on painting Scions. I wish I'd found this, remember this video existed before I started working on the ones I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But what I did know before I found the video, but it's in there, is about painting stripes. And he mentions, and I'll try to paraphrase what he says and also give my own experience of painting stripes. You want to find, you know, an area where you want the stripe to be. And this is if you're not using masking tape. If you're using masking tape, you want to use the Tamiya tape. I really find it to be the best tape for miniatures. It seems to have that level of tackiness that sticks right where you need it to be and still doesn't pull up the paint when you peel it off.
Yeah,
that's even sometimes when you seal it, that masking tape, if you put it on, so, you know, the moon is shining just right and you go to peel it off and it pulls up a piece of paint and then you hate life. So I'm going to talk about masking tape for a second. You can actually untack some of it. So sometimes if you find that yours is too tacky or you feel like it's going to betray you, you can just like stick it on your shirt for a second and pull it off, and that'll remove some of the tack, but not enough to where it won't stick on your miniature.
Mm-hmm. You might want to use a lint-free option though.
Pant leg, shirt, or whatever. I guess maybe a table. I don't know. But it doesn't take a whole lot to just get it to that perfectness, even if it's a little bit too tacky.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're hand painting the stripes, you always want to be pulling down towards you. So have the miniature positioned in such a way that you can paint vertical stripes towards your own body. That's going to allow you to get you a nice, smooth, straight line.
That's a good tip.
And then what you see in some of these tutorials is their brush size. I've talked about this a little bit in the past before, but they use brushes that are largely comfortable for them. And if they're really good at it, it's basically the better you are at painting, the larger the brush you can get away with using.
Yeah, that's always surprising to me how big a brush a lot of people use.
In the tutorials, you see them coming in like, I would never be able to, who cares if you got to use the 00 single horsehair to paint an eye? As long as you get that eye painted, nobody's going to care.
Exactly.
Well, so take that when you're watching some of these tutorials as, you know, maybe something to, if you don't get the result exact the same way they did, maybe you want to use a smaller and or bigger brush, depending on what the project is. So I use the medium layer brush from Citadel a lot. But when I get a little nervous or I don't feel like I can get the things exactly right, I don't have any problem breaking out the fine detail brush, whatever that happens to be, whatever range you're using. So when I'm painting these stripes, especially when I'm going around what is a piece of ornate metal trim or something.
Mm-hmm. Lots of that in 40K.
I go one level, one brush smaller, and I make thin lines pulling down towards myself until I'm happy with the width of the stripe. And if you get that outside stripe on both sides, if you get the left and right outside stripe exactly like you want it, then you can just fill in the middle and it takes a little bit of the stress off.
Because I am sweating even with you talking about this. I'm tripping buckets here.
Well, I appreciate you. You've followed along. But I mean, these are things that you could work forever on a stripe.
Yeah. And this is why I avoid stripes at all costs.
And be fighting against it, that could eat up all your hobby time.
Yeah.
And so with just a little bit of I guess confidence and with the steadying your hands and coming at it from that downward stroke every single time, you're going to get better and better stripes. And then if you're still not happy with it, you can clean up the edges with the base coat, whatever the base layer of paint is.
Yeah.
Although I try to avoid that because sometimes it just doesn't always dry right. Either the consistency of the paint is not the same or something or whatever. I prefer to try to nail the stripe, and how I nail the stripe is painting down towards me. I paint the outside edges first and then fill in the middle.
Well, I'm just lucky that I've never fallen in love with the Iron Hands. They're the guys with the hazard stripes, right?
Those are all, yeah, hazard stripes everywhere.
Yeah, all of them.
Although those used to be on everything. They used to be on every Power Fist, every Chainsword.
That's true. The yellow and black hazard stripe was a real second edition touch that used to be on everything.
It was. Well, that's my finishing moves. When I feel comfortable enough with these Scions, I'll actually post some pictures of them.
Unveil them.
They have a stripe on their shoulder pad and then their elbow pad, and getting those stripes to line up with the various twists of their arms and stuff was a little bit of an exercise, but that's how I went through them all. And I don't know, they're all pretty consistent, and I like it. I like the look.
Well, I look forward to seeing how these things round out.
I've gone in and tried to chip them up a little bit, and I'm not 100% happy with how that looks just now. Again, this is they're a little bit of a struggle. I don't know if it's the model. I don't know if it's the fact that I'm still recovering from being in Vegas. I don't know, but something.
Yeah, the shaky hands probably don't help with painting stripes on Scions.
I'm struggling, but they're gonna get good. I think continue to plugging at it, still being confident, finding ways to. I got to the point of desperation, and then when looking for tutorials. To see if there was some secret sauce that I was missing.
Hey, there's always someone out there who's struggled with the same things you have when it comes to this, and has probably recorded a YouTube video about it.
That's the truth. Well, Val, that's all I really wanted to cover tonight. I know that we still haven't done a proper Gene Stealer Cult review.
True. I've heard some pretty gnarly things about that book.
It's got tricks. I mean, mind control stuff is still there. Shrouded deployment's in there. This is going to be something that definitely influences what people play. But I don't know. I haven't properly assessed the power level of it as it stacks up, what I think stacks up. I've kind of tell people that I'm just not scared of many things popping up next to most of the armies that I play, but I could be grossly underestimating.
I'm sure you give that many tricks, including, you know, a deny stratagem's ability to something that can take a lot of CPs. You give that to the right person and they're going to be able to do some mean things with it. Heck, Index Gene Stealer Cults played correctly were winning tournaments in the right hands. So I'm sure giving those same people lots of tricks will make them a force to be reckoned with for sure.
Well, it's just stuff like, you know, even Cult Lehman Russes get the Cult Ambush ability. You know, I think there's going to be lots of different ways to come about building this, and it's going to be fun to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. I'm down.
All right, man. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap this up?
No, I think we touched on all of it. Just want to reiterate my great thanks to everyone who was involved with organizing and running the Las Vegas Open and give me a wonderful thing to go have a lot of fun with a lot of my friends at. It was just a brilliant event, and I can't wait till next year. And it'll scarily be here before we know it, but I look forward to it nonetheless.
Oh, man, have a great rest of your night.
You too.
See ya.